I'm here to discuss the issue of topic analysis. For each debate in which individuals are participating, there is a motion, a topic, a resolution that is subject to issues of dispute. And the affirmative or proposition side will defend the topic, and the negative or opposition side will argue the affirmative's interpretation and support for that topic. Topic analysis is both the responsibility of the opening team in the debate. It is their obligation to successfully interpret the topic, to successfully frame the debate, but at the same time, it's an enormous strategic advantage. In order to establish the foundation for the debate, one also has a number of different options to explore the way in which the topic ought to be used for the purposes of a debate. There are four modes of interpretation that I will note. The first is a literal interpretation of the topic, and by that I simply mean a commonsensical or popular, usually referred to as a reasonable person standard. What would someone on the street believe if they heard the wording of a particular topic and decided to interpret it for a discussion? This kind of interpretation is limited strategically, but is available to a government or affirmative debater. The second kind of interpretation is often referred to as a parametric interpretation of a topic. The parametric interpretation simply establishes that there isn't a single reasonable interpretation of a topic, but that any statement constitutes a range of ideas, a set of ideas. And the role for the interpreting team or individual is to select from that range of ideas the best possible expression of their understanding of the topic. The third kind of interpretation that one might introduce in a debate is the extended analogy. In this circumstance, the interpreting individual recognizes that the topic constitutes a particular idea, and then they take that idea and extend the idea to a target statement. And in the extended analogy, the speaker has to display some loyalty to the original interpretation of the topic. For example, if the topic is in singular in number, then there's an expectation that the extended analogy will also be singular in number, that one wouldn't transpose the grammar of the topic so that a singular topic became a plural interpretation. It wouldn't meet the test of an extended analogy. If we use an example and say that a topic has a single agent of action, the United Nations would carry out an international environmental program. By analogy to international actors, the government or interpreting team might not be able to argue that multiple international agencies should carry out a program of environmental protection. They would be changing the nature of the topic, not interpreting the topic. The final mode of interpretation really does allow complete license for the interpreting speaker, because the final interpretation of the resolution, of any resolution, is to say that the speaker will interpret it as metaphor. The speaker will simply say, this topic stands for something else. The idea may be similar, but it also may be dissimilar. And all of these are interpretive possibilities for a speaker in a debate. After all, these are techniques of interpretation that we use daily. We understand the world in a literal sense. We understand it in a parametric sense. We use extended analogies, and we also live our lives and interpret ideas by metaphor. And so all of these are interpretive possibilities for the affirmative or the government side in a debate. What is the popular model of topic interpretation? Well, it seems to me that there's a fairly conventional one, and that is that when given a statement to interpret, the opening speaker offers key word identification. By that I mean that the speaker identifies terms in the topic that might be of a technical nature or might be subject to critical interpretation, and for the purposes of the debate, they define those individual terms or phrases. The rest of the topic, the remaining terms in the topic, are typically not defined, and they are understood in a literal sense. Some debaters, particularly clever debaters, recontextualize a topic after they use a keyword identification. They recontextualize a topic in typically one of two ways. In policy debating, speakers typically recontextualize a topic as a plan, a solution to a problem, a means of action, a functional interpretation of the topic. If a plan calls for a particular action to be taken, for example, the United States government should establish a comprehensive system of health insurance for its citizens. The government or affirmative team on that topic may simply propose a plan of action instituting national health care. That would be their functional interpretation of the topic, their recontextualization of the topic as a plan of action. In parliamentary and many forms of public debating, sometimes in Lincoln-Douglas debating, there is a recontextualization of a topic as a case statement. And so one might be presented with a given topic, and at the conclusion of keyword identifications, this particular phrase, for the purposes of the debate, will mean the following. And after the debater has gone through that set of keyword identifications, the debater then issues a case statement. They take the words that they have defined and then take those definitions, reform them in the original context of the topic, and then issue a statement, for the purposes of this debate, the topic will mean, and then offering their interpretation. Because words are subject to different definitions and interpretation, as the interpretation changes, the topic changes. This is how a topic interpretation becomes a strategic advantage for a government or affirmative team. The team or the individual in Lincoln-Douglas debating can select an interpretation that gives them an edge relative to their opposition in a debate. The individual terms forming the language of the proposition often tell us the kind of proposition that a proposition may be, but they don't tell us how we should argue the proposition. There are different kinds of propositions, but there are generally recognized three kinds of propositions: propositions of fact, propositions of value, and propositions of policy. A proposition of fact makes a simple factual claim. The United States is in a recession is an example of a proposition of fact. A proposition of value argues that something is good or compares a particular position in a relative sense to another value claim, arguing that it is a relative good. For example, liberty interests ought to be valued over principles of equality. And a proposition of policy calls for a policy action to be taken. The World Health Organization should adopt a comprehensive policy to significantly reduce AIDS in Africa is an example of a proposition of policy. The terms in the topic tell us whether or not it's a factual claim, whether or not it's a value proposition, or whether or not the motion is a proposition of policy. But that's all it tells us. On any given topic, one debates factual claims, value claims, and issues of policy. The argumentation is distinct from the way in which one might analyze a topic.
I want to talk now about some of the issues that are involved in preparing for a debate from the point of view of the tack that one might take in the preparation time, maybe 15, 20 minutes, maybe an hour, perhaps even longer, perhaps a few days, for your debate. The first thing that I want to say is that the most useful thing you can do, the most useful thing you can spend your time on, is obviously constructing your own case. That seems to be self-evident. But what also is incredibly important is that you try and anticipate arguments that other people will bring up in opposition to you. I think this is important not just in some abstract sense, but also in a very practical sense. In reality, I guess your brain is much more focused on talking than it is on thinking when you're actually standing up. And as such, this means that it pays to have done your research beforehand. Your presentation will be much more polished, your answers and analysis will appear to be much more fluid if you're able to have thought about the issues beforehand. And that's the crucial thing about your preparation time, is that you need to divide it, evenly or not, between preparing your own case and anticipating the arguments of the opposition. And I think perhaps the way you do this is first of all to write down the ideas that you think will be compelling on your side, to pre-prepare your case, to prepare the ideas that you want to advocate as being the most important, maybe the moral, social, political, economic ideas that motivate your plan and advocate your side of the issue. Then you want to think about the ideas that the other team will come up with, kind of questions that they will ask, which may be questions of definition or resolution, maybe counter-argumentation against your moral, social, economic, political points, that kind of thing. Once you've thought quite carefully about the issues that you think your opponents will raise in their case, I think the most important thing is that you then attack your own case, which is a very different thing from thinking about the issues that your opponents will raise. You spend time investigating individual arguments that you will present, and you ask yourself the question, why is that wrong, and what can I think that will answer that point? The next stage is obviously to counter your counter, which will mean that when your opposition raise questions to you, when they bring advocacy that counters your case, you're able to say straight away, because you've thought about it beforehand, the kind of things that will provide the solution to their problem. So you investigate the ideas for your side, you investigate the ideas for the opponent's side, and then you argue against those individual ideas. The second skill that I think is crucial during your preparation time is an analysis of which of your arguments are the strongest. For example, in a discussion about reparations for slavery, whether or not the United States government should provide reparations to African Americans who were victims of slavery, it seems that there are two sides to the motion. One side is the issue of practicality, how you will implement the plan, and the other side is the issue of principle, the moral imperative that we must make amends for our bloody past. Now, one would have to choose very carefully in a debate whether or not the issue of who will pay, how will we pay, who will we pay to, how much will be paid, whether or not those issues are in fact sufficient to counter the moral issues. In a similar vein, if the debate has been phrased entirely as an issue of pragmatics, i.e. entirely an issue of how much it will cost, how much the plan will impact various segments of society, that kind of thing, then the burden is on you to assess whether or not the moral imperative or the principle opposition is the one that you wish to take. Because after all, the economics of thought idea says that it's better to use big, important ideas to oppose your opponent rather than small ideas. And that's a very important thing to bear in mind. A crucial part of preparation is to make this prioritization between arguments that are weak and arguments that are strong. The second issue that I want to talk about today is one of research and how you go about preparing yourself for a debate. I think there are a few things that I want to say on this subject. The first of them is the issue of the library. Know where it is, know how to use it. If you don't have access to one, try and get access. It's imperative to have good sources of reference material in order to construct cases, to find out facts and figures. Secondly, there's the question of which sources to use. In my style of debate, quite often people will resort to magazines such as Time or Newsweek or The Economist or New Scientist or Scientific American. And those are great starting points for general arguments about how you will prepare or what kind of arguments you will use. I think there are also issues of using and abusing new media as much as possible. It's incredibly exciting at the moment that one is able to gain access to things like Britannica online and type in issues such as the Constitution or reparations or ideas about euthanasia and abortion and receive lots and lots of very, very useful information back and articles and indications of where further information can be found. I think also you need to pick a good search engine, something like AltaVista or maybe Ask, where you can ask these questions, you can type questions in and be given useful starting points to begin your research. In addition, there are various sources of collections of arguments that you might want to use. The English Speaking Union produces a book called Pros and Cons, which has a variety of different arguments in favour and against a whole selection of different issues. And such books can sometimes prove invaluable for jogging your memory or providing a basic introduction to where the heart of the issue lies. These are things that you will obviously need to do before a debate starts. But I think after the debate finishes, there is a certain amount of research that one needs to do. And that research involves making sure that you file and keep the debates that you've presented. There's no point in wasting time rethinking old arguments when you've already invested you've already invested heavily in thinking up arguments before. So keep copies of your old debates. In addition, if you found yourself in a debate not understanding an issue or not having enough facts at your fingertips, go and do the research that provides those facts and stuff at your fingertips, because inevitably these issues will come up again and again from different perspectives. The final thing that I think is crucial about research is the issue of questioning your own opinions, because most debaters find that the most difficult cases to counter or to propose are those which they do not believe. And as a result of that, it is often the case that we are arguing against opinions that we've always held and that we've never been forced to question. Therefore, I think one of the most important things you can do, for example, if you're an artist or you're into humanities, things like English, history, languages, that kind of thing, read science and vice versa. Make sure that you are that you are Catholic in your tastes, Catholic with a small c. And in addition to this, identify your own individual opinions that you make assumptions about and try to find argumentation against them. If you happen to believe that abortion is absolutely abhorrent, find the arguments that say that it's not, research them, understand them. If you find abortion completely an issue of choice and utterly happy with it, find the arguments that say that it is abhorrent and should be outlawed or that legislation should be passed against it. And as a result of this, you will strengthen your own beliefs and you will also strengthen your own strategies in debating. And I think those two things are crucial.
I'm going to talk to you for a brief time on research. Hardly something that you can teach in a brief period of time, but some of the things I want to share with you I think will be useful. First, I want to talk to you about strategy. When you are engaged in research for argument and debate, you want to have a strategy as you approach your research. The first element of the strategy is pretty important. Limit yourself on the depth of the research. There's only so much research you need. You have to realize that you're only going to speak for a limited period of times in the debates you're going to have. We are not, as debate and argument people, going to demand a sophistication of your arguments similar to what we would demand of a person who is, for example, writing a dissertation or a thesis. You just need to do the research that you need to get done in order to make the arguments. And I think one of the problems that most beginning debaters have is they begin their research, which is difficult, but it's not too hard to learn how to research. And after you learn how to research, you tend to not make the transition to the next step, which is to compile the research and to actually design sophisticated arguments. You tend to continue just researching. And that becomes counterproductive. You only need enough research to make your arguments, and researching beyond that might be useful for doing some scholarly work, but isn't going to necessarily make you a much better debater. The next element of the strategy is limit yourself on the basis of resources. We all deal with the externalities of the world around us. Try to use the resources which you have available. If, for example, there's a college or university library that's somewhere near you, you might want to take advantage of that. You might want to take advantage of the libraries you have in your own town or your own city. There might be situations where you don't have access to sophisticated libraries that carry maybe a lot of periodicals on policy sciences and a lot of material that might be useful in designing some sophisticated arguments in policy debating. That doesn't mean you can't debate. It just means that you might want to choose a strategy that is related to the quality of resources that happens to be in your immediate environment. As I mentioned in another lecture I gave on these videos, you could design criticisms of foreign policy based upon treatises written throughout history on politics. There's a lot of possibilities. You need to focus on the type of research that is possible with the resources you have. And you can design arguments no matter what the resources are. If the resources are finite, then those arguments should be designed to take full advantage of the finite resources you have. The third element of the strategy is limit yourself on the basis of schedule. Many students need to understand that there's a lot of things that fill their daily lives, and you need to schedule in research time. You need to limit the amount of research you can engage in based upon your current schedule. You don't need to strip your schedule in order to do research, and at the same time, you need to schedule in some time to get the research done. The second step in engaging in research is define the resolution you're debating. Spend good quality time sitting down and thinking about what the resolution means, what each word in the resolution means, what each term in the resolution means, and what the resolution may mean as a whole. Every debate is going to be based on some sort of resolution. Whether it's a parliamentary debate and the topic is resolved that crime pays, or whether it's a policy debate and the topic is whether the United States should provide development assistance to the Greater Horn of Africa, you have many terms in these resolutions which need to be precisely defined. If you don't know what they mean, that's where dictionaries and encyclopedias come in handy. The third step in designing research is evaluate your resources. The first thing you want to evaluate is your personal knowledge. Don't discount it. Try to figure out what you do know about the debate resolution and what you don't know before going to the library and engaging in research, for example, on the internet. There's no reason to do research on items that you know enough about. Instead, focus on the material that is new, novel, and will be different from what you also already know. The other thing I would suggest in evaluating your resources is interview friends and colleagues. Spend some time talking to the people around you, and they might provide you with useful bits of information, which you can then use as a starting point for your research design when you start researching the debate policy that you're examining. The next step, I guess the fourth step, would be check on the secondary sources. Most of the research you do will be based on secondary sources, and there's three of those we want to talk about. The first is check encyclopedia and almanac resources. They provide a lot of useful information. They provide geographic information and historical information that you may need in order to do sufficient, adequate, and sophisticated research. You may not know enough about the history of an area that you will be debating or the history of some element of policy, and you need to learn that first before you start doing your research. After that, you want to check library resources, since most of us will go to libraries to do research. We generally talk about three categories of resources. The first are books. And books are really good when we're debating resolutions that are not really time-bound, that are more timeless. It takes a long time for books to be published. And so even a book that comes out in the year 2000 or the year 2001 might have been written 2 years prior to that. Also, some libraries have sophisticated interlibrary loan systems where if a book isn't available at your local library, it can be acquired from another library through interlibrary loan, and it's a way to extend the library resources of in terms of books. Periodicals exist in a lot of flavors. They're the hard versions of them, which we normally see on magazine racks, and are found in our libraries as well. After a while, our library tends to either bind them into hardbound versions or else put them on our microfilm or microfiche. And we need to know what periodicals the library has when we start doing our research and on what formats the material's found. Because oftentimes when we're doing our research, we are going to find ourselves forced to sit down with a microfilm or microfiche projector in order to do the research at the levels we want. Especially since a lot of government periodicals and government publications now come out on microfiche, it's important for you to be able to know how that resource is used at your library. There's a lot of other categories associated with library resources. Most libraries have some sort of government collection, which would have resources published by the government, which might be worth reading. They also tend to have a collection of pamphlets. These are fugitive materials that are sent to libraries, which you don't want to really put on a shelf because they'll fall behind the shelves. And so libraries tend to keep them in certain bins or vertical files, and they're often incredibly useful because they provide strong synopses of whatever it is you're reading and researching. The third category of secondary resources is internet-related. We're all getting wired onto the internet. It's incredibly pervasive throughout the United States. There's three things to be worth mentioning. First is find a search engine that works for you. There's some search engines on the internet which are called mega search engines, which combine a lot of smaller engines. So try doing advanced searches on them. For example, in the United States, Yahoo, AltaVista, many of these standard engines have mega search engine design built into them. They also have advanced search capabilities. You can click on an advanced search and actually do more precise searching on the internet. There are some search engines like Google.com, which provides a fairly sophisticated mega search engine as well. And you'll discover that search engines go in and out of favor. There's always new ones coming into effect. And talking to other people about it or just watching carefully on the internet will make you aware of that. If not, the reference librarians at most libraries will be able to help. The second thing on the internet worth looking at is newspapers online. Most major newspapers now have online sites, and a lot of the information that is found in their newspapers will make it online. And some of these sites require you to pay for subscriptions, but a lot of the sites remain free. And there's excellent resources for things like New York Times and Washington Post, Christian Science Monitor, and most of the large city newspapers. Finally, there's very sophisticated search engines that are for rent, and things like Dialog and LexisNexis. Most colleges and universities in the United States have special arrangements where students can engage in this type of research, and it's paid for pretty much out of their tuition. A small degree of their tuition goes to pay for these services. These are all pay-for services, and anyone using the services without paying a fee and registering appropriately is committing fraud, and you really need to discourage this. But most libraries have some sort of system like this and will let you use it. The next thing I need to mention is quite simple. Record the information, especially its sources. One thing I think debaters tend to do poorly is recording information accurately. Get a complete citation so you can go back to the source and find the material again if necessary. Record the text so it's accurate. So if you are going to include that text in a debate as the basis for the argument, make sure it's complete. It's not that you have to read every word on that text. You can read a sentence and skip a sentence and read another two sentences and skip another sentence and read the next sentence, and that's fine. But you want material to all be recorded so you can share it with your opponents in a debate situation. So get accurate text as well. Last, file that information. It is imperative that the information be filed in some logical fashion so you can use it to construct arguments later and make those important briefs. My final statements on research are basically helpful tips. The first helpful tip is maintain bibliographies. If you are using a bibliography to do your research, make sure you file that away so you have the bibliography when you need to go back and update the research later. Next, maintain search strings. When you're searching on the internet and you put a series of words together and those words are the basis for your search, record them. Save them for future use so you know what you used the last time you searched for information so you can repeat it or so you can change it to do a better search. Finally, enough is enough. Just do enough research in order to be competitive as a debater, in order to make arguments. There's no reason to continue to research beyond the point where it's going to be productive in the construction of arguments. In terms of research, you have a general strategy, define your resolution, evaluate your resources, learn those secondary resources that you have available to you, make sure the information is recorded so it can be useful, and take advantage of some of those helpful tips as well. Thank you. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about briefing and the writing of blogs. Briefing is an organizational step we have in debate and argument, especially in competitive debating, which involves organizing your research in some coherent fashion so it will be a complete argument and can be presented as such. It reduces the amount of time one has to spend within a given debate organizing his or her material and allows for a more coherent presentation in a debate setting where you are debating with a partner. In general, the structures of briefs are fairly straightforward, but they fall into two basic categories. The first category we call the shell, and the second category we call the extension briefs. The shell brief itself is the basic structure of an argument that is presented probably the first time the argument is introduced. It tends to be a short brief, often only a page or maybe two pages long at most, and it tends to have abbreviated argument structure within it, which will then grow into a more mature argument as the debate progresses. In terms of the shell itself, the shell is constructed with simple language that tells a clear story of how the argument is constructed. For example, if perchance you were going to present something like a disadvantage in a policy debate, the shell would probably begin with some basic thesis statement telling the audience and critics what the disadvantage would be about. Next, it would follow some basic linkage story which would explain why the disadvantage is relevant to the policy that is being debated. There would be some story, some scenario, some internal link story which would explain what would eventually get to an impact or end story, which would describe why the disadvantage is more important than any of the advantages the affirmative might claim from their policy. Now, the shell itself needs to be brief, and its purpose is to introduce the argument into the debate, the argument then to be fully completed as the debate progresses. The completion of the argument is often referred to as the blow-up. What happens in the blow-up is that specific areas of the argument are extended or blown up. Hence, the second type of brief we see in academic policy debating is called the extension brief. What the extension brief does is provide more rationale for each of the units found in the shell. For example, in the illustration I gave you about a disadvantage, one of the units of the shell would be the link story, why the disadvantage is relevant to the policy being advocated in the debate. What would happen in an extension brief would be a much more articulated link story. It might explain the link story in greater depth. If, for example, the disadvantage was going to be arguing that the costs associated with adopting the affirmative policy would be undesirable, what the link extension briefs might be is a fuller articulation of what the costs would be and what they would entail. You would also have extension briefs designed for the internal link or scenario story, and you might have extension briefs designed as well for the impact story. Also, you will notice that when you're running an argument, you can predict with some degree of security what the opponent's arguments in response might be. Responding to those arguments happens to also be a function of the briefs. You can design response briefs as extension briefs. If you know, for example, when you're running your disadvantage, that your opponent may argue that the policy they're advocating actually saves money rather than costs money, you might want to have an extension brief already designed which indicates that the cost savings do not occur at the inception of the program, but many years down the line. Hence, the disadvantage occurs, even though in the long term, the policy might end up saving money. So the structure of briefs tend to fall into the categories of shell briefs and extension briefs. What is in a brief itself? Well, the following units need to be on the brief. The first is a series of assertions. In other words, if you have a set of assertions which would make to any argument that the opponent would present, you might want to write those out on the brief. For example, if we are dealing with the disadvantage that says that the costs of the policy are undesirable, you might have a series of assertions that you make every time the argument is run against you. Those assertions might be that there are other issues more likely to produce whatever impact the negative may be arguing in that debate, or that the scenario they're talking about in terms of budget cuts is not a wise scenario and likely to occur and such. These assertions should be articulated on the brief. Also, there should be clear referencing in the brief, especially on extension and in response extension briefs. You should reference back to evidence read earlier in the debate instead of rereading it, which is definitely not time-wise. So you can refer to evidence often by the source of the evidence itself and by the date of the evidence and a functional summary of what the evidence said. In the brief also, there should be tags, and tags would be simple statements, often not even complete sentences, which describe what the evidence you are about to read is about and what argument you will claim with the evidence you're reading. So the content of the briefs generally are assertions, some referencing, and tags with evidence. How do we use briefs? Well, we use briefs in a lot of different ways, but the most powerful use of the brief is to have a standard set of critical arguments that one can make against their opponents. You can fairly well predict, given a debate resolution, what your opponents will probably argue, with some set of exceptions. The ones that you can predict, you can design a whole series of briefs against. The suggestion is, when you design these briefs, remember they have to be capable of being edited on the fly. In other words, as the debater turns and picks up briefs to be read in a debate round, it should be relatively simple for the debater to pull evidence from the briefs, add assertions, remove assertions, and change referencing as necessary. Now, the brief is still there to help you, but the brief is not something you should be locked to at all. A good illustration of briefing that occurs in policy debates has generally been associated with something called the political disadvantage. In the current campaign, in the current tenure of President G.W. Bush, the political disadvantage would argue something to the effect that if we try to adopt the policy advocated by the affirmative, it might occupy the focus of the president. The president may not then be able to focus on some other more compelling policy, and that's undesirable. This argument has near universal application in debate rounds, since everyone would need to advocate a policy, and a policy through normal means would have to go through the president in one way or another. This type of an argument is particularly well designed for extensive briefing. You could produce a shell to be read in the debate round. You could produce a whole series of extensions based upon what you believe your opponent's responses might be. Some tactical considerations. The briefs need to be very clean and clear and generally well-typed. The reason being is that in the debate round, you really don't want to have to spend time trying to decode what a brief is saying. You also might want to take bits of information that you are using as evidence in the brief and blow it up so it could be easily read. Often when we're collecting evidence in debate, we may, for example, Xerox a page out of a book. Now the print is relatively small, and as it goes through generations of copying, it might actually degrade. You probably want to blow it up, make sure it's very clear and easy to read, so you can be very efficient with your briefs. The other thing to consider and tactically in terms of the briefs is that briefs will be copied. They'll be copied by your colleagues if you happen to have a large debate team, and you'll be copying your briefs in order to cut them apart and restructure them and rewrite them. And so try to make sure you keep an archive of the briefs you have done. There's nothing worse than having cut apart a brief and using it and then finding out you really craved the original once again, but it's however has been lost. Currently, we use briefs in academic debate, and they tend to be text-based. In other words, they are simply 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper on which arguments have been written, a series of assertions. You might have taped down pieces of evidence and with their tags. As debate progresses, it is highly likely that we will eventually turn these briefs into scanned images, or we will do the briefing entirely on the computer, in which case we'll be reading briefs directly off the screen. In terms of briefs, they're critical for organization. They fall into two structural categories of the shell and the extension. The content of a brief should include assertions, referencing, and tags with evidence. Predict the arguments of your opponent and make the briefs editable on the fly. Make sure your briefs are clear, well-typed, easy to read, and understand that they're important adjuncts to be an effective debater. Thank you.